What do we got coming up on Tuesday?
Party
after the exam? Perhaps. What should you be studying for the exam?
Drugs.
And that doesn't just mean ingesting them yourselves. That means learning their names, what type of receptors they're specific for, their effector mechanisms, you know, all the different metabotropic pathways, which one do they tie into, what specific G protein, what downstream second messengers, what are their sort of macroscopic effects, what are they used for clinically?
Protein cycle was different from the one that we had originally studied in the first exam. Is it because it acted through beta gamma units, or?
Well, we
I just remember making note of that.
You made note of that. I don't recall that. We have talked about both alpha subunit mediated effects and beta gamma subunit mediated effects. So you should know all of the above. Okay. You should know enzymes, biosynthetic pathways, and degradation pathways, and the ones where we have talked about blockers for them that are clinically or experimentally useful. You should know those. What's the most common substitute that's used for acetylcholine experimentally, for instance? Carbacol. Very good. Okay. One person might have gotten that on the next exam. Now, many people should get that on the next exam. Okay. All right. For today, one more thing. When are review sessions coming up? Today, when? 6 o'clock. And I believe there's one on Saturday or Sunday. Is that correct? It was up on the board, but it's been erased. Was that last Saturday? Okay. And I think there's also the regularly scheduled one on Monday as well. Okay. Anyone here not in a study group at this point in time? If you're not, you should be. Particularly if you're planning on going on beyond UTD in your educational progress. That's the sort of skill that other schools like to see that you've already learned how to utilize. That you don't depend just on your own knowledge, but that you both get practice explaining what you know to others and also admit the fact that you might have missed something and somebody else might have gotten it. Share the wealth around that way. Hopefully not share incorrect information that way. Okay. All right, for today we're going to talk about the last of the biogenic amines, histamine. It serves as a neurotransmitter, as a major irritant, but also a vital necessity. Anyone here never digested their own food, for instance? Pretty much I think everyone that's sitting here today has digested their own food. Well, you depend on histamine for doing that. Let's look first at the role of histamine peripherally. Okay, and this involves three of the four known types of histamine receptors. We're going to come back to the receptors in more detail later on today. The primary reason that most people know anything about histamine is because they take drugs called antihistamines. Anyone here not ever taken an antihistamine? One, maybe two. And they're very commonly used compounds. They're involved in suppression of generally of inflammatory or congestive or allergic type responses. And in fact, they play a role even in orgasm. Think congestion and inflammation there. You might get some clues. Okay. Most of the histamine involved in those comes from a group of cells called mast cells. Mast cells. They're found throughout the body. And the histamine released from them acting through what are called H1 receptors causes these general congestive type responses. H1 receptors. We'll come back to the mechanism of action and specific drugs for that later on. Now, the vital necessity role of histamine is the action of histamine type 2 receptors, H2 receptors. Okay, in your digestive system, when you eat food, you increase the secretion of this peptide, gastrin. Gastrin. And gastrin acts upon receptors, they're called gastrin receptors, that are found in your gastric mucosa, the lining of your stomach, the gastric mucosa. And when these gastrin receptors are stimulated, it causes these mucosal cells to release histamine. Histamine is released from the lining of your stomach, from the gastric mucosa. That then acts upon H2 receptors in a different class of cells, what are called the parietal cells. Have we ever heard the word parietal before?
Yes.
Parietal cortex. This has nothing to do with the brain. These again are in the stomach lining, and that causes secretion of gastric acid. Anybody know another name for gastric acid?
Hydrochloric acid.
Hydrochloric acid, or the more common nomenclature is just called stomach acid. Okay, it vastly increases the, or sorry, decreases the pH of the stomach contents and begins the breakdown of the food that you've ingested. So you wouldn't be here today if you didn't have good functional histamine release mechanisms in the stomach and H2 receptors for that histamine. Then, of course, we all presumably have intact immune systems as well. And there are different class of histamine receptors are involved. The H4 receptors. H4s. They're present on a wide range of different tissues in the immune system. Basophils, neutrophils, and on bone marrow cells. And they play a very strong role in regulating proliferation in the immune system. H4 receptors. And up until probably 20 years ago or so, this was considered the major functions of histamine. It's only within the past couple of decades that we've recognized that histamine is an important neurotransmitter as well. It's as important as the other biogenic amine transmitters. How many of you have studied very much about histamine neurotransmission? Very much none of you. Unfortunately, because most of the training that most of your faculty received dates back about 20 years, whether they admit it or not. The people that taught them, the textbooks they read, the kind of focus that they had. And that's unfortunate. So we actually know a lot about histamine in the central nervous system now as well. The other faculty should get themselves up to speed. Moeller talks about it good. Well, I would say his training was probably considerably longer than 20 years ago. But Dr. Moeller keeps up with things. Okay. Neurons that release histamine as a neurotransmitter are called histaminergic cells. Just like we have dopaminergic neurons, adrenergic neurons, catecholaminergic neurons, these are histaminergic neurons. They have a transporter that takes in the raw material. It's called the alpha amino acid transporter, or AAAT. The raw material, the precursor, is histidine, an amino acid. Amino acid histidine. It's acted upon by a single biosynthetic enzyme, histidine decarboxylase. Histidine decarboxylase. It's not the AAADC that we've seen for other biosynthesis of other biogenic amines. This one's specific to histamine. Histidine decarboxylase, HD, converts the precursor histidine into the neurotransmitter histamine. We often use HA, It's the abbreviation for Hist Amin. Okay. Of course, it's got to be packaged up into vesicles by a vesicular monoamine transporter. This one is present to some degree in all the other biogenic amine neurons as well. It's not proton dependent. It's not the major packager for other neurons, though, but it is for histamine neurons. So it's released in a calcium-dependent fashion. It can bind to receptors, and we'll come to receptors again in just a few minutes. It can then be broken down by the degradatory enzyme HAMT, histamine methyl transferase. Histamine methyl transferase, or HAMT. And the breakdown product is this molecule here, telemethylhistamine, TMHA, telemethylhistamine. Now, what's missing that we've seen in other biogenic amine neurons? A synaptic reuptake mechanism. They would be called HATs if they existed, but there are no HATs. There is no synaptic reuptake. So you don't have drugs designed to block reuptake of histamine. Hence, we don't have that big, long chart with an additional column in it. Okay. So biochemically, a bit simpler than most of the other systems we've looked at so far. One enzyme for the biosynthesis, one kind of transporter to get it into the cell, the raw material, but not the neurotransmitter, one very simple vesicular transporter, one enzyme to break things down. Okay. What else did we look at that could break down histamine? MAOs could as well. Which kind of MAO? MAOA or MAOB? B, okay, because it has an A in its abbreviation. It's acted upon by MAOBs. But where does histamine come from in the nervous system? Does it come from your stomach? Does it come from your bone marrow? It comes from tuberomammillary neurons. Tuberomammillary neurons from the tuberomammillary nucleus. Is located deep within the hypothalamus, sort of at the base of the hypothalamus, near the mammillary bodies, right behind the stalk for the pituitary, the tuber, tuberomammillary nucleus. And it's the source of histamine that projects throughout the nervous system, even down into the spinal cord. Throughout the forebrain, midbrain, brain stem, and spinal cord. Very widespread projection patterns. Of course, you knew there was histamine throughout your entire brain, right? Now you know. Plays an important role in the brain. How many of you know very much about the tuberomammillary nucleus? Studied that extensively so far, right? Cover a little bit about it. Remember, we've looked at things that had abbreviations A1 and so on, B1 and so on. Well, the tuberomammillary nuclei have E numbers, E1 through 5. They're outside the traditional boundary of most of the other nuclei in the hypothalamus. It's small clusters of neurons, small clumps. Few of them are close to the ventricle, but most of them are widely scattered through the hypothalamus. The neurons themselves are very large, have fairly extensive dendritic branching, and very long, very poorly or very weakly myelinated axons. If there's not much myelin on the axons, do they transmit quickly or slowly? Very slow transmission. Okay. But each of those neurons forms an extremely large number of synapses. Hundreds of thousands on up to millions of synapses per tuberomammillary nucleus neuron. Contacts lots and lots of targets. In fact, they're typically located immediately adjacent to neurons that release a substance that's important in regulation both of sleep and of eating, a substance called hypocretin. Hypocretin, peptide transmitter. Anybody know another name for hypocretin? Orexin. Yep. People studying sleep like the word hypocretin. People studying feeding like the word orexin. It's exactly the same molecule. This is the structure of hypocretin. Please don't draw it. As compared to the relatively small and simpler structure of histamine. Okay. Histamine plays an important role in sleep and waking. Okay. Has anyone ever gone in the drugstore and seen compounds like this, or even compounds like this, that advertise something relative to sleep or arousal or drowsiness? Compounds like this advertise themselves as non-drowsy formulations of antihistamines, supposed to not put you to sleep. That's as opposed to a product like, say, Benadryl. If you take that, it will probably render you unconscious. This is exactly the same drug as Benadryl. It's marketed under a lot of other brand names, specifically to put you to sleep. It will also help you deal with allergies and things, but that's not what it's marketed for. That's because when we get sleepy, there's a relationship in firing activity between the different areas in the hypothalamus. This region, the ventrolateral preoptic nucleus, or VLPO, ventrolateral preoptic nucleus of the hypothalamus, has an extremely large number of receptors for adenosine. Adenosine. Anybody here ever drink a beverage that contains an adenosine antagonist?
Yes.
What would that beverage be?
Caffeine.
Anything containing caffeine. Okay, coffee, soda, Red Bull, any number of products. Vaguely related substance is also found in tea, theophylline. These act as antagonists for one of the classes of adenosine receptors. When high levels of adenosine build up, and this artist was a little challenged, this means high levels weighted down on the scale here, the cat in this case gets sleepy. Lots of adenosine. It makes you groggy. Caffeine helps block that effect. When there's high levels of adenosine stimulating the ventrolateral preoptic nucleus, that increases inhibitory outputs from that nucleus, GABAergic and GALAergic, and that inhibits the tuberomammillary neurons that synthesize and release histamine. So when you get sleepy, levels of histamine decline. You can make yourself sleepy by blocking histamine receptors in the brain with antihistamines. Does that make sense? When you sleep, you remove most of the adenosine and generate ATP. Build up reserves of ATP for waking activity. So as levels of adenosine decline, the inhibitory output from the ventrolateral preoptic nucleus decreases. That then allows increased activity. It's weighted more now in this artist's conception from the tuberomammillary nucleus. More firing of those neurons, more histamine release. So awaking states, arousal states, are correlated very strongly with high levels of histamine throughout the nervous system. Histamine helps wake you up and keep you awake. Anyone ever heard of this drug, modafinil? That's one of its many names. Modafinil, or its precursor, adrafinil, have been very widely used by the U.S. Armed Forces in our several wars over the last decade as a substitute for amphetamines, because they don't have some of the side effects of amphetamines. People taking them do not report that they crash, and crash very hard afterwards, as they do with amphetamines. People taking modafinil exhibit increased levels of histamine in their nervous system. It's not a histamine agonist, but it seems to stimulate activity of neurons in the tuberomammillary nucleus. We're not entirely certain of the mechanism of action. It's not a direct effect, doesn't look like, on those neurons. It's some indirect pathway. But the net effect of increasing histamine again keeps individuals awake. In fact, people report that on drugs like modafinil, they can stay awake for a week at a time.
What happens afterwards, though?
They stop taking it, and they sleep normally. And that's quite different from what somebody does if they've been on amphetamines for a week. And then sleep for a week afterwards. Have all sorts of other issues as well.
Does it show the same fatigue like if you were just to stay awake without a drug? Or do they stay regularly alert?
That appears to be individual and dose dependent. Some people don't report being fatigued. Some say they're tired, but they're still awake. And for the Army, they seem to think awake is good enough. Awake and alert, obviously, is better. And since a large enough percentage of people report both, that's made it a very popular drug for their use.
Dr. Thompson?
Yes?
Do you know if anyone has studied the relation of like drugs like that and like post-traumatic stress disorder?
I don't think so. That would seem like a wise thing to do, wouldn't it? Now, essentially, they're carrying out unregulated clinical trials right now. Okay. excuse me. It seems to be part of the cost containment strategy. Get soldiers to do more with less soldiers. You know, if you can get somebody to not have to sleep, you know, for several days or a week at a time, that means you need a third less soldiers. Because they'd be out of action at least, you know, a third of the day. Ideally, you know, two-thirds of the day. So it seems to the Pentagon, at least, to be a cost-effective strategy. What happens to people when they return from military service? That's been very much an afterthought. Very, very much an afterthought. And we'll probably be paying for that for a long time to come. We did after Vietnam, we did after other wars as well. Yes?
The soldiers that are taking it must still express cognitive deficits due to the lack of, especially brain sleep.
You would think so. There has not been a large scale double blind study done on that. But you would think so. They're probably not, at least not really good at learning something new during that period. Yes?
Is there a difference between taking these drugs and a caffeine pill?
Caffeine is only effective for a few hours, typically. And, you know, you have to keep ramping the dose up, and you're still generating more adenosine. This seems to be effective for, you know, a week or so. So, yeah, not just quantitative, but qualitative difference there, it looks like. Okay. All right, if we look in the nervous system for where histamine is found, the green fluorescence here is the presence of histamine. It's found very widespread. Red is lower levels of it, but it's still a reasonable expression. We do get differential expression of different receptor types, but again, they're very, very widespread. It's not limited to just one particular function in the nervous system. It seems, in fact, to have a general arousal function, and probably more than just simple arousal. The sorts of things that we've typically assigned to other neuromodulators in the past, histamine seems to play at least as important a role in. And we're only beginning to assess, you know, whether it has diverse other functions. In the central nervous system, people seem to like having high levels of histamine. It may share some overlap in that sort of hedonic function with dopamine. There's an awful lot more work needs to be done about histamine. And I think just the random coupled questions I asked here is a good indication of our general level of ignorance about histamine and the amount of work going on with regard to histamine. And that seems shocking to me, but also probably somewhat tragic, because we've been concentrating on older things and essentially ignoring other important modulators in the nervous system. And that usually comes around and bites us really hard. So how many types of histamine receptors are there? From what we've seen so far, four would be a good guess, and it would actually be an accurate guess. The one that we left out for the periphery was the H3 receptors. Again, this looks like a really complicated chart. Let's break it down and emphasize the important parts of it. Four different types of histamine receptors, H1 through H4. H1 through H4. Sometimes you'll see them as HARs, then it would be HAR1 through HAR4. But the more common nomenclature is just to use the letter H, 1 through 4. They share three different G protein mechanisms. H1s act through GQs. Okay, if they act through GQs, what do they do to phospholipase C activity? They increase it. So what kind of products would you expect to see increased? Diacylglycerol, IP3, and presumably increases in intracellular calcium. H2s act on GSs. H2s on GSs. So would they increase or decrease adenylate cyclase activity? Increase it, stimulate it. Ask for stimulate. What would that do to cyclic AMP levels? Should increase it. What would that do to PKC activity? Should do nothing. It's not in that pathway. What PK should it increase? PKA activity. Okay. Similarly, H3s and H4s both act through GIs. So what would they do to PKC activity? Nothing. What would they do to PKA activity? Decrease it. Because if you inhibit adenylate cyclase activity, you're going to produce less of what product?
CAMP.
Cyclic AMP, not CAM. CAMP? Oh, okay. Cyclic AMP. The H3 receptors, when they're found presynaptically, are autoreceptors for histamine. autoreceptors. Again, that appears to be mediated largely through the beta-gamma subunits. H3s, when they're found presynaptically, are autoreceptors. What do autoreceptors do to release of that particular neurotransmitter? Decrease it. Okay. H3s can be found postsynaptically as well. And it looks like H4 receptors are also found postsynaptically. H1s and 2s are found postsynaptically. It looks like H1 and H2 receptors share that common function of the arousal or wakefulness in the central nervous system. What's sort of common about GQs and GSs? Are they generally excitatory or inhibitory in their effects? Excitatory in their effects. Okay. And then everything at the bottom we talked about already. Other cells in the periphery. We'll touch on other effects in the central nervous system as we go along. Okay. So how many types of receptors? Which is the autoreceptor? Okay. Which are the sort of excitatory receptors? And which are the more or less inhibitory receptors? Okay, that's basically the take-home message from this slide. In the central nervous system, histaminergic neurons, the ones that have all the enzymes for biosynthesis and the transporters for packaging them up, release histamine in a calcium-dependent fashion, and it can then act upon all of the different classes of receptors, H1s through H4s. It can act on the autoreceptors. Again, what type of receptors are the autoreceptors? The H3s, and inhibit the calcium channels and thereby decrease release of histamine. Interestingly, H3 receptors are also commonly found on presynaptic terminals of other neuron types. Cholinergic neurons, dopaminergic neurons, adrenergic neurons, some glutamatergic neurons. So histamine can act to inhibit release of other neurotransmitters as well. A much wider range of effects than any other type of autoreceptor mechanism. Not just an autoreceptor for histamine, but playing an important regulatory role in down regulating or decreasing levels of release of other transmitters. Again, by blocking the amount of voltage-dependent calcium channel activity. And since neurotransmitter release is calcium-dependent, it then blocks release of other transmitters. When we look at the firing of tuberomammillary neurons, normal spontaneous firing, they tend to be tonically active cells. They fire very regularly. If we apply an antagonist for the autoreceptors, they fire more frequently and release more neurotransmitter. But if we look at the calcium currents, H3 agonists block a significant fraction of the calcium current presynaptically.
So the agonists
The agonist blocks the calcium current. The antagonist actually increases the amount of neurotransmitter release and increases the rate of firing. And I think that's probably more than enough mechanistic that most people want to be responsible for. What do we do with ligands, with drugs that interact with histamine receptors? Peripherally, there's a wide range of different applications. You can go into almost any store around and find a drug that will interact in some way with histamine receptors. Probably even in hardware stores. For effects on H1 receptors, many, many, many over-the-counter drugs act and are marketed either as allergy treatments to deal with congestion or to deal with inflammation. In fact, most drugs that will do one very likely will do all three of those things. Antihistamines. There's a broad range of drugs that are marketed as antacids, not to blot up the acid or to neutralize it, but to prevent its release. No, that's not proton pump inhibitors either. It blocks the histamine type 2 receptors, the H2s, and thus prevents the stimulation of release from the parietal cells. Okay. Central acting drugs. There's a wide market for antihistamines as antiemetics, anti-vertigo treatments for prevention of dizziness, car sickness, seasickness. We'll look at a lot of drugs in that sort of category in a few minutes. H1 antagonists are used to induce sleep. In fact, it looks like there may be some endogenous H1 antagonists in some species that hibernate. We don't know very much about them at this point in time either. How many of you have studied bears in a lab, for instance? Probably not the most prototypical lab animal. Who would like to be in charge of feeding the bears in the lab on any given day? Don't get too close to them.
Yeah.
That applies to primates as well, though.
Yeah.
Bears at least don't throw certain things at you that primates do. The bears are more interested in evaluating whether you'd be a good snack or not.
Yeah.
There's been application of categories of drugs as stimulants for treatment of Alzheimer's, as nootropic drugs to enhance learning and memory, for treatment of ADD, and for potential diet uses. So wide range of different potential clinical application. Guess which one is the most popular? These. Some of the purple pills as well. Now again, this looks like a really complex chart, but it's not. Let's break it down. Pay attention to the important, relevant information. What is the endogenous agonist for all of the types of histamine receptors?
Histamine.
It agonizes all four types of histamine receptors. Okay. If you have trouble digesting your food and you're not producing enough gastric acid, you might take a drug like Vimeprit. Vimeprit is reasonably specific just for the H2 receptors. So you can dose dependently increase the amount of stomach acid without having a horrible congested feeling. Demiprit. Propoxyphan is a partial agonist for the H3 receptors. Propoxyphan. Partial agonist for H3s. What are H3s again? The autoreceptors. Drugs that have this IMA prefix, like imapiptid and imapip, are not as selective. They're agonists for both H3s and H4s. The IMA, or IME, or however you'd like to pronounce that. H3s and H4s. There's lots and lots of other drugs in this category. I don't expect you to learn all of them. This list could have gone on for about 40 pages. But these are the ones that you'll most commonly see. And in fact, they're involved in all of these different sorts of functions. Sneezing and congestion, rashes, digestion, immune responses, and cognitive effects. Okay. Now we've thrown a term around a lot today, antihistamine. Do you expect antihistamines to be agonists or antagonists?
Antagonists.
Okay. And this is a large chart. Let's break it down. The drugs that are classically called antihistamines, ones you can walk into a store and tell the person working behind the pharmacy counter, I need an antihistamine, will be reasonably specific for H1 receptors, antagonists for H1s. Okay. The one that's still most widely used, and you can get it in all sorts of different formulations, is diphenhydramine. Diphenhydramine, first marketed as Benadryl, but it's literally in hundreds of different brand names. Diphenhydramine. Okay. Then we've got these so-called non-drowsy formulations, like fexofenadine or loratadine, with dine suffix. Or adenine suffix sometimes helps to remember. These used to be only by prescription, now you can get them non-prescription, slightly lower doses. Okay. If you buy an over-the-counter drug and it isn't diphenhydramine, most likely it may be chlorpheniramine. Chlorpheniramine. It's actually a little cheaper to make than diphenhydramine. It doesn't seem to be quite as good, but since it's cheap, it's in a lot of products. The ones in red, add another one, cetirizine. Are mostly marketed as sort of treatments for allergies, sniffles, things of that sort. Decongestion, but not the type of decongestion that you sell things that act on adrenergic receptors. These are targeting histamine receptors. Some products will combine both. Then we have products that are designed, or at least not really designed, but marketed for their effects on the inner ear. Not on the cochlea, but on the vestibular apparatus. The prototypic one of those is diamine hydronate, which was marketed as Dramamine, which made D-Day possible in World War II. Without drugs like that, most of the soldiers would have been vomiting too hard to hit the beaches. Diamond hydronate. These days we have newer drugs, less side effects, so they don't make you as groggy. Drugs like meclizine, promethazine. They don't make you groggy. What does that probably tell you about them? They don't cross the blood-brain barrier as much. Okay. Some formulations are marketed exclusively as making you sleepy. Doxylamine. Do you think that did or didn't cross the blood-brain barrier? It does. But you could take for all of these effects, take something like diphenhydramine, Benadryl. It'll make you sleepy. It'll get rid of your rash or your sniffles. You won't be dizzy, but you'll be unconscious. You wouldn't really know that. So it blocks all the different sorts of things, itchy and scratchy, whether you're awake or asleep, dizziness, and the sniffles. Right, so it's clear that antihistamines are what category of antagonists? H1 antagonists. Are these metabotropic or inotropic receptors? Metabotropic receptors. So would we be talking about any non-competitive antagonists? Is there an ion channel to block? No. Okay. I lost a table in here somewhere. Oh, dear. You're really regretful that you don't have more drugs to learn, huh?
I'm sure you can recite it from memory.
I think I'll spare you this time, though. I think we'll skip the effects altogether. I'll just mention that since this is one of my fields, nootropics, there's been a lot of use of H3 antagonists, the autoreceptor antagonists, looking at nootropic effects. This is a range of different rat behavioral assays that have been tested. Pretty much all the different types of learning and memory tests that rats can perform, H3 antagonists produce beneficial facilitation of learning and a retention of learning. So having more histamine, rather than have a cognitive deficit, actually seems to produce a cognitive benefit. So there's a potential, at least, that modafinil, rather than have some long-term deficit, at least if it was used on some type of a schedule where you still did get some REM sleep occasionally, might actually improve things, since it increases the levels of histamine as well. Okay. I'm sure everybody's going to be disappointed, but that's it. So what should you be learning for this next exam? And not just drug names, but what they do and how they do it. But if you don't learn the names, you're going to have trouble.